This is the third installment of a chilling true crime tale we began unraveling a few weeks ago. It explores a case within the murky depths of family dynamics, where love and desperation collide. A sinister plot unfolds, one that transcends the realms of divorce and custody battles. Today's case at hand is not the typical saga of a marriage gone bad, but rather a harrowing narrative of evil plans resorting to the unthinkable in a quest for ultimate control.
Join us as we unravel the third layer of this tragic crime and dive into the depths of the human mind and the chilling motivations that drive individuals to commit unthinkable acts in the name of control and possession.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 8. Today is part 3 of a case that we began to explore a few weeks ago here on the Dark Livity podcast. I'm your host, Kimberlea, and I'm here with my co-host, my boyfriend, my best friend, Jonathan.
Hi.
We're so glad you're here. And if you like our content, please don't forget to subscribe and hit that notification bell so you don't miss an episode. Mm-hmm. And we really hope that you've watched the two previous parts of this saga. If not, we would highly recommend that you stop and you go back to watch part 1 and 2. I will put them in the cards and below conveniently for you so you can get to them ASAP. We do firmly stress that you do not watch this episode without knowing the entire backstory of everyone and everything we're going to be diving into today. I will say we're going to get pretty far into the story because, as most of you know, I am not a fan of two-parters, definitely not three-parters. So this is a stretch for me. I do love deep dives, though. So we will try our best to start wrapping it up in a big bow for all of you.
If you've already caught up with us in part 2, then you'll know we left Dan Markell being shot and his ex-wife being questioned by Detective Isom for about 5 hours. One reason we wanted to highlight that interview is because there were some red flags that even some of you noticed that we didn't even mention. Here's a woman who knew her 2 children were with Dan the night before and heard the horrible news that Dan's been shot at his home, the home that they used to share. Not only did she drive to the exact area where the crime took place and was even spotted by an officer, but she admitted to Detective Isom that she drove down Trescott Drive and saw the yellow tape. In her explanation, she said she thought a tree had fallen down. However, she didn't stop and ask what happened. She didn't call Dan's phone to see if he was okay. She didn't call the school to make sure her kids got to school safely. Nothing. Instead, she quickly made a 3-point turn, left the area to go to a nearby liquor store to grab a bottle of Bullet Bourbon for the Stock the Bar party she was supposed to attend that evening.
I found it funny that she couldn't even say the word bullet to the detective. When he asked her what kind of bourbon, she said it was Boulay. And I wonder why, but considering her ex-husband was just shot with bullets, I think she might have come off as a little cold and insensitive. But for the record, there is no evidence as we know of right now to suggest that her friend's invitation, which we've already heard a lot in the comments about, included this specific alcohol or not, and there's any connection with this crime. I've seen comments saying that they think there was some kind of signal to co-conspirators that she knew the job was done, saying that her credit card was connected to theirs, they had access to her records, and when she made the purchase, they saw it. I've watched all the trials and that has never come out, so I am not here to speculate on that. Theories are always interesting to entertain, but we really do want to try to stick to the facts. One of which is that Wendy didn't seem to have a babysitter lined up for that night. In fact, the detective spent a considerable amount of time trying to locate anyone who could pick up Wendy's boys when she was being interviewed. I've made the argument that if Wendy truly did plan to attend that party that evening, she certainly would have lined up someone to watch the boys. So why not just call them and tell them to pick the boys up earlier? One person kept commenting on everybody's comments and stating that the party was kid-friendly. But here's the thing. We have no evidence of that. What we do have evidence of is her lack of a babysitter. That is a fact, because they were scrambling to find someone at the last minute. I don't know if this was a kid-friendly affair or not. We just don't have that information. But all these coincidences add up to suspicion, and I'm not giving this woman the benefit of the doubt. Not after everything I've seen and heard. I'm only going on what we know. She never once demanded to see her kids. Sure, she wanted to get home to them, but she never demanded to leave that room to take them to their father's bedside. Instead, she worried about him looking scary. I mean, okay, I understand that, but that would be the last time they may see their father. They already had him wrapped up. He was cleaned at this point. He's in the hospital. I think that would have been one of the most important things, to let her kids say goodbye, or for her to demand to leave and be by his side instead of him being all alone, dying in a hospital bed surrounded by strangers. I have no sympathy for Wendy. She knows the law. She's a lawyer. So I hold her to a higher standard. I mean, I'm not licensed to be an attorney, but I did graduate from law school. I know the law, and she wasn't arrested. She could have told them, you know what, interview me at the hospital. My ex-husband is dying. I don't always give my opinion, but I've kind of had it with this woman and the clever and conniving way that she tries to manipulate everyone around her. And this becomes more and more clear.
We ended the last episode with Wendy in her own words.
I can't help but feeling like this is all my fault.
In case that was hard to hear, she said, I can't help but feel like this is all my fault. And that's a very loaded statement. She already mentioned feeling like, since she's complained so much about Dan, maybe someone close to her would do this because they thought it was a good idea. And further, if she hadn't divorced Dan, maybe he would still be alive. But are those normal thoughts one should have?
I didn't think so, unless they probably said in the past, I wish you were dead, or this would be so much easier if Dan was gone, if he would just disappear. And I know that I said I wouldn't speculate, but I've gone through dealing with my daughter's father, for example. It's not always easy, and we even get along, but I know other people. My mom even went through a divorce with kids involved, and I've seen how crazy things can get, and that's why I promised myself I would never go into family law, because I can't handle it. And I've heard people say those things, that they wish that their ex was dead. And I don't think they mean it, but it's obvious Wendy and her family hate Dan. I can say that confidently.
Right. And Wendy feels that it's somehow her fault, but she also gave up her brother's name in the first 20 minutes or so of that interview, saying that her brother, Charlie, was joking about hiring a hitman. A joke she admitted repeating to the TV repairman who came to her house on the day of Dan's murder, an appointment her mother and brother set up for her. To get a TV looked at, Charlie bought her as a divorce present instead of a hitman, saying because it was cheaper. Now, Detective Isom was looking into Charlie and also Wendy's ex, Jeff Lacoste, who was suggested as a possible suspect by Wendy's friend, a colleague of Jeff named Jane, saying that he's been jealous. All right, so that's the recap. So let's get into this.
Oh, and someone mentioned in the comments of the last video that it was interesting to them how Wendy had been complaining to Dan that she had lost her voice so much so she couldn't talk to him all week about a very important aspect of their son Ben's life, his kindergarten education, something Wendy knew Dan was very concerned about and they had limited time to decide upon. However, she tells Detective Isom and even talks to Jane herself about an outing that she and Jane had taken that week when she supposedly didn't have a voice, where the two of them went on a walk and talked all about Wendy's concerns with Jeff, which is very interesting because Wendy, as I said, is manipulative. Wouldn't it stand to reason if Wendy had just that week before Dan was shot confided in Jane that she was worried about Jeff and his jealousy becoming concerning? She could be planting the seed that maybe Jeff was capable of doing something crazy. I don't think that that's too far off base. And Wendy asked Jane, who would do this? Well, Jeff is the first person that came to Jane's mind, and I wonder why. It's just too convenient.
At this point in the timeline, Wendy was escorted back to her house to be reunited with her boys. She had notified her parents about Dan being shot, and they had agreed to immediately take the 7-hour drive from Miami to Tallahassee to be by her side.
One caveat real quick, the call to her mom. That was awkward. One, she didn't demand to call her parents right away, and that blew my mind. Instead, a couple hours go by without her notifying her parents that the father of their grandchildren is in critical condition and may die. She hesitates so much about this call, a call that, in my opinion, should have come right away. She still had her phone for quite some time before they took it away. Once she made that call, and it was a short one at that, but of course, Wendy herself didn't have many of the details at the time, she hangs up and then turns to the victim advocate and relays that she's relieved Which again, it stands to reason that Wendy was concerned about making that call and relieved because she believed her mother's reaction was appropriate considering how much she knows that Donna hates Dan. I don't know if that was a Freudian slip or what, or if Wendy is just making excited utterances out of fear or anxiety, but they sure do seem odd.
Yeah, it's like she expected Donna to say something callous like good riddance. Oh, he's gone.
I'm sure she would have, and I'm sure Wendy was afraid of that.
Maybe even something incriminating.
Exactly. And at the end, before she hung up, she's trying to say one last thing, but Donna hangs up too fast, but then calls her back soon after. The thing that Wendy was so desperately trying to get out before hanging up was, can you please tell Charlie for me? As if this wouldn't be the most horrific or worst thing that's ever happened to someone, and you wouldn't be alerting the whole family. It's almost as though she's planting these little seeds, knowing that everything's being recorded, to make it seem like, well, none of her family, all the way in South Florida, would have somehow gotten the news. They'd be so in the dark that Charlie would need to be notified. It's like she's doubling down that Charlie would be so far removed from this entire debacle that he would have no clue. And I just felt like it was a little overboard considering what's going to be revealed in this investigation.
And what happens next is detectives have one solid lead from James Geiger, Dan's next door neighbor. He's an eyewitness who said he saw a light-colored Prius leaving Dan's driveway right after the gunshots rang out. Isom also has a timeline of Dan's whereabouts that morning. He knows he dropped the boys off at Creative Preschool sometime before going to Premier Health and Fitness to work out. That's where they need to start. The timeline is always one of the most critical aspects of recreating the moments leading up to someone's murder.
Right, but it wasn't a murder yet. It was an attempted murder. It's true, Dan wasn't expected to survive, but at that point, he was still alive when Wendy left to go back home. His parents had yet to be notified, but finally they did locate his father, Phil, in Colorado visiting with friends. I cannot even begin to imagine how devastating that call would have been. And Phil was now responsible for notifying Dan's mother, Ruth, who was out in Montreal celebrating her uncle Laser's 97th birthday. The landline at Laser's rang instead of Ruth's cell phone. Someone picked it up and told her it was Phil, and she wondered why he wasn't just calling her cell. But once she heard his voice, she knew that something was wrong. He asked her to sit down, and she had never heard him sound this way before. He said, "Something terrible has happened. Danny's been shot." Ruth said in her book, The Unveiling, that she went completely numb. When she could finally speak, she said, "What do you mean?" She told Phil that she'd just spoken to Dan that morning and that Dan told her he'd call her back like he always did. I can't imagine the pain and confusion they were feeling in that moment. Phil explained that Dan was shot in his car while he was parked in his garage a few hours earlier. And of course, Ruth wanted to know what Dan's condition was and why they were just being notified so many hours later. Of course, Phil tried to explain that they had a very hard time finding their number, which I honestly blame Wendy for, because she deleted the numbers in her phone that she said she was no longer using. This would include her own children's grandparents. So that stalled the detectives from being able to notify them, and that is just cruel. They had to utilize Facebook to try to find Dan's parents. It's almost as though Wendy wanted them to suffer. Just like Dan.
At that point, Phil explained that the detectives had relayed the news that Dan had two bullets lodged into his brain. And the friend that Phil was with at the time was actually a doctor. And after speaking with him about Dan's condition, the doctor friend told Phil that there was no chance that Dan would survive. And if he did, he'd most likely be a vegetable. He would have severe brain damage.
I need to break in and clarify something just for a minute. Someone argued in the comments, and I welcome it, by the way, I really do. I want things to be abundantly clear, and we try our best to explain them in detail, but because there was a delay with the medical personnel on scene, they were about 20 to 30 minutes behind. The argument was made that Dan could have been saved. And as much as I am a wishful thinker, and I have seen miraculous things happen medically, our brains are so fragile, and a projectile piercing through causes so much damage that it would be highly unlikely. But to be fair, we haven't gotten that far in the story yet. It is coming. We're going to explain everything that happened to Dan, but unfortunately, there just was not a chance.
Define saved, you know? Is that like Saved where you're conscious and lucid, or saved where you're just breathing?
Like the friend said that was a doctor, he would have had brain damage. So yes, he might have still been breathing, but the damage would have been so severe.
And of course, upon hearing the news, Ruth's whole world came crashing down. It was clear to everyone around her by the look on her face that something really bad had happened. When she hung up the phone, she knew she now had the horrible task of telling her uncle the news. She couldn't bring herself to tell him Dan was going to die. That would have been too much, but she did relay that he'd been shot. And at first, Laser just sat there and stared, but then this 97-year-old man brought his fists up into the air and slammed it down on the table while uttering the word machatnum. That word in Yiddish means in-laws.
Wow. If that's not telling, I don't know what is. You know what he was saying? He was pointing the finger right at the Adelsons. He knew how contentious the divorce was, how much hell Dan had been through. Even with maybe a limited understanding of all that Dan's family had witnessed and had been relayed to him by Ruth, Uncle Laser knew right away. At that point, Ruth hadn't even considered this tragedy a murder. She said in her book, that wasn't something in her vocabulary, but it didn't take long for Dan's rabbi to call her and explain that Dan only had a couple hours to live. And then he put her on the phone with the ER doctor, who talked about surgically removing the bullets from Dan's head. But the doctor never mentioned anything about this being a life-saving procedure. Instead, it was clearly to preserve evidence. That's the first time Ruth realized that this was much bigger than just her son dying. Someone did this to him on purpose, and there would be a long road ahead of her. She knew she wouldn't be able to make it to her son's bedside before he passed away. She was much too far away from him. And that makes me so sad. His childhood flashed before her eyes. It was unreal.
We want to take you back in time just a bit, because while Wendy was in that interview room, things were unfolding around town, specifically in regard to other people close to Dan hearing the same news that there was a shooting on Trescott. The same news Wendy's real estate agent received, though limited, it made her reach out to Wendy immediately, just to see if she and the boys were okay. A normal response, as we explained in our last video, is a natural reaction when you hear or see something scary that happened in close proximity to where someone you know lives. In the first video, we briefly talked about Dan having another couple over for the Shabbat, the Coens, Tracy and Jeremy Coen. What we didn't tell you is that the Coens met Dan and Wendy at a Christmas party back in 2007, and they became fast friends. The Coens also had two kids, two daughters, Molly and Paige, who were actually in the same age range as Ben and Lincoln. So they thought it was perfect. The couple would frequently visit Dan and Wendy's and the kids would hang out together. They even went to the same preschool. But not only that, back in 2009, it was Dan and Wendy who told the Coens about the home for sale right down the street from theirs at 2275 Trescott, only about a minute away from them. Well, of course, the Coens inquired and they actually ended up buying that house, which meant they became even closer, not just by proximity, but also in their friendship with Dan and his family, especially with them being Jewish.
Well, Tracy was at her office on the afternoon when Dan was shot, and her sister texted her that there had been a shooting on Trescott. And again, as a normal reaction, this is the street that she lives on. It's a street that her close friend Dan lives on with his children. She reached out to Dan. She sent him a quick text asking if he was all right, but she never got an answer. No one could give her any information about what was going on, so she left the office as soon as she could to get home and make sure everything was okay on her street. When she drove by Dan's around 4 p.m., the perimeter was no longer blocked off anymore. Cars could freely pass through. But there was a police car in Dan's driveway, so that alone was a sign to her that whatever happened, happened at Dan's. So as most of us would, she stopped at her close friend's house and she asked the officer what happened. Well, he couldn't give her much information, but he did inform her that the resident of the home had been injured. Tracy immediately called Tallahassee Memorial Hospital and asked if a Dan Markell had been admitted. Because of privacy laws, they couldn't provide any details about his condition, but they were able to confirm he was there and in the ICU. Do you see the normal steps that someone who actually cares will take in an emergency? All the ones that Wendy never took. That's a huge red flag.
And later that night, Tracy and her husband were still trying to get the entire picture of what happened to their close friend Dan. They were still in the dark, but finally, around 10 p.m., a mutual friend got in touch with Jeremy and told him that a limited number of people would be permitted to visit Dan, a Of course, that makes sense because there was an open investigation going on, but Jeremy didn't hesitate. He rushed to be by Dan's side. When he got into the room, he saw Dan lying there all alone, hooked up to a bunch of machines. His head was wrapped with gauze, with one eye swollen and exposed. It was unreal, but Jeremy was hoping Dan would pull through. He thought Dan would, because he said he knew Dan would do anything he could to fight for his boys and to be able to be in their lives. For the next hour or so, Jeremy talked to Dan about his boys, about life, and everything in between. Even if Dan couldn't hear him, he just wanted to be there for him. Just a little before midnight, Jeremy decided to leave Dan, but promised Dan he'd be back the next day to see him. That visit would never come because poor Dan took his last breath shortly after 1 a.m.
See, his friends, the people who cared, went to see Dan, to be there. And Wendy, she made no effort at all. It's sad. But then again, when you realize all of the facts of this case, I think it's better off that Dan had truly genuine people by his side. And I think you know exactly what I'm saying. Going back to what was happening, Ruth was one of the first people that was notified that Dan had passed away. Around 2 a.m., she got that call. The wounds were too severe for him to survive. He had a brain hemorrhage that proved to be fatal. By 6 a.m., she was making her way out the door to meet her daughter Shelly at the airport so they could get to Dan as fast as they could. Before leaving, she gave Laser the devastating news that Dan was dead. Laser just shook and cried and told Ruth to update him when she made it to Florida. Within just a few months, Ruth would also be laying her uncle Laser to rest. And she believed the sadness and stress of Dan's murder contributed to his passing. This poor family. Dan's sister Shelly helped Ruth keep it together. She knew that Dan belonged to Congregation Shamrai Torah, and by the time they were able to get in touch with the head of the temple, they were informed that Dan's friends and congregation members had already set up a memorial for him the very next day on Sunday at noon. Things were happening so fast. Later that Saturday, July 19th, Ruth made it to the hotel where she, Phil, and Shelly were staying in Tallahassee. They had dinner at a friend's house, and by 9 a.m. the next morning on Sunday, the day of Dan's memorial, Detective Isom was there at the hotel. They met him in a conference room to discuss Dan's case and everything that had transpired since his shooting. Detective Isom told them they had already interviewed a number of people, including most of Dan's closest friends. But of course, they had a lot more interviews to conduct. They had also designated Dan's house as a crime scene, and they were now in the process of searching it for any valuable clues, going through his computers and paperwork, especially trying to locate things like his life insurance policy. Ruth said in her book, they were following the money right away. Now it was time for Detective Isom to tell Dan's family all the details about what happened to him. So I think it's a good time for us to tell you what the medical examiner found during Dan's autopsy.
Dr. Anthony Clark performed Dan's autopsy examination on Saturday, the 19th, following his death. Dan was shot two times at close range. Prior to performing the autopsy, x-rays were taken of Dan's head. We're putting those up on screen now for those watching. There was one bullet still inside the center of Dan's skull, and the other was inside the left side of the face. But upon a lateral view, you can see the bullet is actually at the back of Dan's skull, and the other at the left side of the jaw. Though this is where the projectiles remained, one actually entered below his left eyebrow and the other in the left cheek area. The left side of his face had a number of abrasions from shattered glass when it exploded at such force from the gunshot. It came in contact with his face at high velocity, ripping into his skin, also injuring his left eye, which became very swollen, causing hemorrhage of the eye and eyelid. This, in Dr. Clark's opinion, was the first gunshot wound because of the injuries from the glass. Remember we showed you a picture of the driver's side window in Dan's car? It was shattered, but some of the glass still remained and it showed a clear half circle which indicated where the bullet had gone through. That first shot shattered the glass and hit Dan while he was still attempting to possibly turn his head to look at who was coming up to his car. Before he knew it, they had pulled the trigger. Dr. Clark believed the second wound was the other one below Dan's left eyebrow because it showed gunpowder stippling, which we defined in a previous video. At close range and without anything between the gun and Dan's skin, the gunpowder left remnants of tiny burns on his face. Dr. Clark couldn't determine how close the muzzle of the gun was on the first shot since the glass intercepted it. However, in his expert opinion, the second shot was within inches. In his report, Dr. Clark stated that it was his belief Dan was alive and still conscious after the first shot. Remember the mark on Dan's left forearm? Well, Dr. Clark believes, as a reflex, Dan raised his left arm to shield his face from the second shot. And what's really unfortunate is that if Dan had not been shot that second time, he might have lived. Dr. Clark did not categorize the first shot as fatal, though it was serious, meaning he would have most likely still sustained brain damage of some kind. To what degree, we're not sure of.
Exactly, that's what we were saying before. Like, he could have lived since the first one wasn't fatal, but that doesn't mean you would have a full life. You wouldn't necessarily be living to the fullest. And what I found equally fascinating and horrifying was what Dr. Clark said about the second bullet. Remember, Dan was wearing eyeglasses? Well, that second bullet apparently struck the frame of Dan's glasses. This seemingly insignificant event that occurred only milliseconds before the bullet entered Dan's brain would have deformed the bullet, causing an increase in damage than it would have if it wouldn't have made contact with anything before hitting Dan. And it makes sense. Had it gone in with a more of a rounded shape, the track would have been more smooth. But with a rigid edge to it, it would rip more violently through his brain. This injury and the following brain bleed is what ultimately caused Dan's death. And that is so terrifying. This whole thing is what this poor man had to go through. And knowing he was conscious, even if it was just for a few seconds, he knew someone was there to ambush him in his own home, seconds from safety. As Ruth was told in detail what happened to her son, her only son, her youngest child, it tore her apart. She knew that she would never want to see the photos. But since she was in shock, she was remaining very calm while Detective Isom began asking the family questions all about who Dan was and who would have wanted to harm him. Ruth racked her brain and brought up his blog. Remember the prof's blog? Well, someone on there had this angry exchange with him. They had recently been accusing him of editing the comment section, and she admitted that Dan was very opinionated and that he held strong beliefs, including his stance on the death penalty, which he was 100% against. Remember, he was into criminal defense, ironically. And Ruth even sat there thinking that Dan would know how to solve a mystery like this one. But the mystery was unraveling, and it wouldn't take long for suspects to be in the detective's crosshairs. Actually, Uncle Laser was on the right track only minutes after finding out Dan was shot. But Ruth, she could only think of the pain that Wendy and the boys must be going through. She didn't want to wait another minute not being by their side. Remember, Ruth had lost her own father when she was only 9 years old. She knew the pain that it caused her. She still dealt with the trauma throughout her entire adulthood. You carry that burden with you. And now, like a generational curse, her own son was gone too, leaving his children behind in the wake of his brutal murder.
After an almost 3-hour interview with Dan's family, detectives drove them to the synagogue for his memorial. People came from all over to honor Dan. More than 200 people were in attendance, even though there had been no time for a formal announcement. All of Dan's friends contacting people who care about him by phone and social media. Ruth was amazed by the outpouring of love for her son, but she had one thing on her mind: her grandchildren. She scanned the entire crowd and finally spotted Wendy and her family in the back of the building. Ben was sitting with Wendy's mom and dad, and Wendy hugging Lincoln in her lap. For a moment, it did strike Ruth as odd that Wendy was not up front like she was with Dan's family. Dan's closest friend spoke, and though Ruth hadn't really done much talking in the past couple of days, she felt compelled to take a stand in her son's honor, almost to speak on his behalf and directly to his two sons left behind. Even if they had no idea what was happening, she figured they would look back and remember her words. She stood and signaled to Wendy to bring the boys forward. Wendy carried Lincoln down the aisle in front, but Ben remained in the back with Wendy's mother and father, Donna and Harvey Adelson.
Ruth spoke directly to the boys. She said, quote, "Benjamin, Lincoln, your father loved you both so much, and he wanted more than anything for you to have Jewish roots, understanding the tradition of the Shabbat and holidays, and to be close to your family," end quote. After those words, Ruth directed this next part to the rest of the people in attendance. She said, quote, "My 5 grandchildren mean everything to me, but when any of them ask me to buy them a pretend gun or other police toys, I say no. We don't play with those kinds of things. We come from Canada, and we don't encourage guns as gifts. We know guns are dangerous, that terrible accidents can happen with them, and that they should not be used for problem solving." End quote. Ruth said she just couldn't help herself from making the statement. Wendy sat there staring at her, hanging on every word, but she uttered not one herself. She just turned around and walked Lincoln back to where her family was sitting. It was the end of the service. Now everyone was coming up to give their condolences to Ruth, Phil, and Shelley. They also began to play detective. Everyone seemed to have a theory about who killed Dan, but still, all Ruth could think about was getting to hold her grandchildren. Wendy had kind of stayed quiet the entire time. She hadn't spoken one word to Ruth yet. She was surrounded by her own friends as they comforted her. Finally, the very first person from the Adelson family rushed forward to give their condolences to Ruth. It was actually Donna Adelson. She had tears streaming down her cheeks. As she sobbed nonstop between breaths and wiping her tears, she told Ruth, quote, "She was so sorry, and that from one grandmother to another, we'll make sure the boys have roots. I promise," end quote. At the moment she spoke those words, they seemed genuinely caring, a promise referencing Ruth's own touching words about Dan's wishes. But in time, they would prove to reveal so much more.
While Donna was standing there, Detective Isom was standing nearby helping Dan's family with what was going to happen next. That's when Donna actually introduced herself to Isom, telling him that she's Dan's mother-in-law, Donna. She shook Isom's hand, saying that this was such a horrible tragedy. Then she had Harvey introduce himself as well. Right away, Isom asked them both if they would mind coming back to the police station. He wanted to gather important information from them in hopes of solving the case. However, Donna and Harvey hesitated, explaining that tonight would not be ideal. Everyone was meeting back over at Wendy's house, including Dan's family members. So Isom handed the Adelsons his card and told them to please give him a call before they left town. You'd think it would be the utmost important for Don and Harvey to follow through on that, but you'll soon start to see that they have their own agenda. And remember, we alluded to the fact that Dan's murder may have happened within just a couple minutes, but this was 7 years in the making.
Ruth was looking forward to spending some time with the boys and exchanging condolences with Wendy, who was getting a lot of attention at the memorial. Even Dan's friends, who weren't exactly big fans of Wendy, came to her side to comfort her. She made sure to let them know that she had put the past in the past, her words. Following that up with, quote, "I'm a single mom to these boys now. They don't have a father figure in their lives anymore, so they really need the love and support of all of you," end quote. She was encouraging those who weren't exactly on her side this whole time to put their differences aside for the sake of the boys. And make no mistake about it, there were two sides. There were friends on Dan's side and others on Wendy's side. There was definitely a distinct divide, and the person who offered up this valuable information was a woman named Tamara Demko. She had gone to Harvard Law School with Dan and introduced herself to Ruth, reassuring her that she recorded the whole memorial and would make sure that Ruth got a copy along with Dan's girlfriend, Amy. Tamara had actually been one of the friends that Detective Isom had interviewed the night before. She was a very close friend of Dan's and knew him for over a decade, and became even closer when she found herself living in Tallahassee in 2007. She also told Isom that she had become very close with Wendy, starting from before the couple were even married, and that she was still friendly with Wendy. She provided some very vital information about both Dan and Wendy, and we're definitely going to tell you all about that later. But first, let's explore the dynamics at play between Dan and Wendy's families when they all made it back to Wendy's house that night. One of the first things Ruth noticed was that Wendy's house compared to Dan's was much more empty looking. She could tell it was a rental, or that Wendy treated it as though it were temporary. There weren't as many toys for the boys laying around or comfy places for them to spend time. And Dan's house, on the other hand, had so much set up for his boys. The home was decorated with their artwork and schoolwork. He even had a clothesline in the living room and hung up all their creations to be put on display. Wendy's place looked sterile. Though Ruth did recognize some of the furniture, the stuff that Wendy had took from the Trescott home when she left it half empty upon serving Dan with those divorce papers while he was away in New York a couple years before. There was a crowd of people already at Wendy's side that night, many who brought over food and other gifts for her and the boys. Donna was acting as the hostess, something that she was very familiar with from all of her dinner parties from the past, ushering people around, greeting the visitors, and she hardly had time to speak with Ruth. Harvey didn't exactly make an effort either. He was wandering aimlessly through the house and merely said a quick hello to Ruth in passing. Strange. And Wendy, she was swarmed by friends, never making an effort to break away and sit with Ruth. All Ruth wanted was to hold her and look her in the eyes and ask her how she was handling everything. But by the looks of it, she really knew how to play the role of the grieving wife. That's for sure. Ex-wife, actually.
In Ruth's book, she said she felt like an intruder in Wendy's home. Never once that night did Wendy stop to give Dan's family any of her time. Instead, she would disappear for long stretches of time, then reappear for a moment, then disappear again. At one point, she passed by Ruth and was in front of her long enough for Ruth to simply ask her if Dan had a will. Ruth hoped that would, of course, spark a longer conversation, but Wendy just gave her a quick no in passing. Ruth said it was awkward.
Now do you know why I can't feel bad for this woman?
Yeah.
Who does that? She's obviously avoiding Dan's family, and I can think of many reasons why she would. It's cold. It's heartless. It's selfish. And soon, you'll see where she gets it from if you haven't noticed already.
Ruth still hadn't been able to hug her grandsons or spend any time grieving with them or Wendy. She, unlike Kimber and I, wanted to give Wendy the benefit of the doubt. She knew how much Wendy must be going through. She sure was in a lot of emotional pain losing her son. So she hoped by the next day Wendy would have the time to get together with Ruth and they could spend some quality time. By the way, we haven't really gotten into the specifics of how much Dan's family really got to see Ben and Lincoln, but it wasn't a lot. Not only did they live far, but the boys were always so busy being passed back and forth between Dan and Wendy, busy with school, and in the last few years, they'd only see them about a handful of times. We know Wendy deleted Dan's family phone numbers and it didn't seem like she had any intention of keeping in touch, and by extension, keeping the boys in touch with Dan's side of the family. It goes so much deeper than this, but it's one of the first clues of how easy it was for Wendy to cut ties with people she felt were not part of her plan for her boys. And you know, she stated herself that her kids were now without a father figure.
Yeah, I thought it was weird that she said father figure and yeah. Not just that they no longer had a father, but right. A father figure. It was strange. It made me go back to when Donna wrote that email to Wendy, trying to give her all these ideas to convince the judge to let the boys move to South Florida, citing that they would have a great role model in Charlie, Wendy's older brother. It was in the first video. I don't recall her exact words, but she was just talking Charlie up, that he was single, that he would have time to be there for the boys, kind of comparing him to Dan always being away on business. It's unbelievable to me that Charlie would be looked at as a role model, especially considering what is about to unfold. But sure, he's successful, he's rich, he's this periodontist in South Florida, but this man has baggage, as it seems like all the Adelson children do, especially Charlie and Wendy.
Speaking of baggage, specifically packing bags, Wendy told Ruth she'd make time for Dan's family to see the kids on Monday when things calmed down. Wendy and her parents were actually in the middle of quickly packing up their belongings. They were essentially getting ready to skip town. Yeah, we'll get into all the specifics, but she had no intention of meeting up with Ruth, and Wendy's parents had zero intention of sitting down with detectives. Their plan all along was to get Wendy and the boys to South Florida. That's been the plan for years, but of course the court wouldn't allow it, but now with Dan out of the way, nothing was stopping them. So while Dan's family was back at the police station early the following morning for yet another interview, they had plans to go to the funeral home to get all of Dan's arrangements settled. Unbeknownst to anyone, Wendy and her family were somehow able to pack up all of Wendy and the boys' things into Harvey's Lexus and Wendy's minivan before heading to Coral Springs. Before all this, Ruth had actually called Wendy that morning asking if noon would still be a good time to get together with the boys. Wendy said it wasn't.
I was like, really? It's not a good time. I would say I can't believe it, but I can believe it. Remember, Wendy's cold. She's heartless and she is selfish. Make no doubt about it, because I know people are going to be like, I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt that I'll still. Mm-mm. There's no way. Like, read the room.
The empty room.
The empty room she left.
According to Ruth's book, when Wendy said that noon wouldn't work, Ruth asked if 1 o'clock would be better. Wendy responded with, not today, Ruth. It's not a good day. And with that being said, Ruth was shocked. She explained in her book that the boys were her only connection to her son, and that when Wendy refused to let her see them, it was a punch in the gut. I mean, can you believe it? Ben and Lincoln weren't in school, and it was summertime. Ruth didn't understand what was more important than family and the boys getting to see Dan's family. She just couldn't understand, but she wanted to believe that Wendy was just grieving, and maybe she was just too emotional to deal with everything in that moment, even though Ruth herself was a mess and trying to hold it all together. But what was keeping her grounded was the thought of being able to see Ben and Lincoln, a piece of her son, his flesh and blood. So she tried to give Wendy some time and asked if maybe the next day would be better. Still having no idea that the thing keeping Wendy and the boy so busy was that they were in the middle of frantically making their escape as fast as they could. Ruth had no idea in that moment that brief visit the night before at Wendy's would be their last family visit in Tallahassee, or maybe the last time she would get to see those boys for a long time. She was so clueless about Wendy's plans and the Adelsons' agenda. Wendy told Ruth she would call her the next morning and figure it out. When Ruth hung up and told Dan's sister Shelly what Wendy said, Shelly was furious. She, along with Dan's father, didn't think it was right. Neither did Ruth, but there wasn't much they felt they could do but wait.
Family was important to Wendy, just not Dan's family. The Adelsons were important. Wendy was never a Markell, and soon, the boys wouldn't be either. Not only had they just lost their father, but soon Wendy would rob them of the Markell name. She'd make excuses as to why she believed changing Ben and Lincoln's last name from Markell to her own, Adelson, was in their best interest, that the Markell name was all over the news, and that she wanted to shield her boys from whatever damage may have been done from their association with their father. And it was for their safety. But we all know that's bullshit. Wendy's book foreshadowed her intentions to leave Dan and to raise their children without him or his last name. Though she created fictional characters like Joshua Stone instead of Dan Markell, her intentions were clear. Like when her character, Lily Walker, in the book, said she was about to adopt the baby. Josh asked if it was officially Lily's baby, and Lily answered yes, name changed and all. And Josh said, Anna Stone? But Lily replied, no, Josh, Anna Walker. Like her mother. If that's not clear, I don't know how much clearer Wendy could have been. Now, the boys' name changes didn't happen right away, but it's true. Wendy officially and legally changed the boys' last names from Markell to Adelson. Not only that, in the process, she also removed Benjamin's middle name, Amakai. Now, that doesn't make any sense. That's not for safety. No.
It's messed up.
It's for suffering. We told you in part one that names meant a lot to Dan. And that middle name specifically was very special. It was to honor Dan's grandmother, who had passed away shortly before Ben was born. Why take that away? Already, Dan's last name wouldn't go on. The Markells only had one son to carry on the Markell name. And now, Dan's two sons no longer were able to honor their father or his family with the name Markell. It's evil.
Absolutely evil.
Ruth wouldn't find this out until over a year after Dan's murder. Wendy callously let her know in an email in September of 2015. But we have a long way to go until that happened.
So much occurred between July 2014 and the fall of 2015. And a lot was also going on the days following Dan's murder. That same day on Monday, when Wendy was fleeing, Isom had set up an interview with Wendy's most current boyfriend, Jeff Lacasse. Remember him? One of Wendy's alternative suspects mentioned in the last video? But before we dive into that, we want to go into just a couple days before to Sunday, the 19th, the evening following Dan's death. Remember we mentioned a good friend of Dan's named Tamara? Well, she was interviewed, and there were a number of things we thought were important to mention. For one, she explained that even before meeting Dan at Harvard, she coincidentally grew up in the same town as the Adelsons. Her family's home was a mile away from their family home, but she never met them back then. She knew Dan about a decade before he even met Wendy, but had been around long enough to see them interact. She's seen the good and the bad. She even knew Wendy's family and hung out with them at least a half dozen times in both South Florida and Tallahassee when they came to visit. For example, when Wendy first left Dan, Tamara went over to Wendy's and her parents were staying there. Tamara got to know Donna. She had some wine with her and chatted, so she'd be a good gauge on how they were acting after Dan was killed. That was probably the most telling part of this interview. But there were other things to mention first, so we'll get there.
Yeah, she told Isom that she'd been at the Adelsons' Coral Springs home over the years for dinner and drinks. She'd even spent time during the holidays with Wendy's family. Tamara said that Donna was very involved and a seemingly loving mother. She was very proud of her children and super involved with both Ben and Lincoln. On the surface, they seemed like a normal family. You know, the type to put pictures of their kids up on their walls, supportive, nothing really out of the ordinary. Harvey was quieter but friendly, and Charlie was very lively. She said he enjoyed partying and definitely tried to act like he was smarter than everyone else, and that he was very protective over Wendy, and she would heavily rely on him, telling him everything that was happening between her and Dan, relaying to Isom that Wendy and Charlie were very close, which Wendy had admitted to Isom herself. But Tamara didn't just talk about Wendy's family. She was candid about Dan and his personality, which was refreshing because we said this before, nobody is perfect. And we like to give a well-rounded picture of the facts. Tamara described Dan saying he could be crass and condescending. He was a typical Harvard nerd and he would rub people the wrong way because he would use big words and came across as arrogant. But Tamara explained it was because he was so confident intellectually and he actually mellowed out over the last few years. He matured. He no longer felt like he had to make such a strong impression. He used to wear bow ties and suits, but he toned it down and would be seen wearing sandals and more casual outfits. Eventually, he even became more silly after the boys came around. She said when you got to know him, he'd win you over. But of course, things changed between Wendy and Dan after the divorce. Tamara was one who said that both Dan and Wendy themselves referred to their friends as either being on Team Dan or Team Wendy. And Tamara felt uncomfortable picking a side because she had become close with Wendy over the years. Although she admitted that following the divorce, Wendy had become more silent. They didn't hang out as much as they used to. However, Wendy would still call her on a regular basis, about once a month, asking Tamara to guest lecture for her, and Tamara would oblige. But once Wendy realized that Tamara had more frequent contact with Dan, she stopped confiding in her. It was strictly business. Except recently. As recent as only just a few weeks before this, Wendy mentioned a possible double date between Tamara and her boyfriend and Wendy and Jeff, who Tamara thought must be a new boyfriend because of the way that Wendy spoke about him. She seemed head over heels. Wendy sounded excited. She told Tamara that everything was great, that Jeff wanted to become more serious, but she was kind of still taking it slow, and this will become important a bit later. But we know that Wendy told a different story to Jane and Detective Isom. Maybe she was just playing up her relationship with Jeff to Tamara, hoping that it would get back to Dan and make him feel angry that she sort of replaced him. He even looked like Dan. She almost like tried to date a copy of Dan, especially because recently Dan had confided in Tamara about how infatuated he was with his new girlfriend, Amy. It was clear to Wendy that Dan was serious about moving things forward in that relationship. In the last few weeks, Amy had just met the boys for the first time and things were really moving along. Dare I say that Wendy seemed a little bit catty and even exhibited undertones of some jealousy when she was being interviewed by Isom. She mentioned how Amy was so successful, but in the same breath mentioned how she was 50, but pretty, and then backtracked and was like, oh, you can still be pretty at 50. This is also the same interview where Wendy was batting her eyelashes and laughing that she got carded at ABC Liquor, saying that she could still pass for 18. She also admitted to Googling Amy a few times. And we know she definitely tried to find out everything she could about this new woman who thought the man that she threw away was a catch. All interesting tidbits.
I'd say so. But the thing is, the real bombshells were yet to come. Tamara really wanted to be interviewed because she felt there were things that didn't feel right about this entire situation, especially within the last couple of days. To get to that, she gave I some context about how, over time, more and more of Dan's friends and even people who were once on Wendy's side were beginning to see Wendy's true colors and starting to believe that Dan's point of view of Wendy to be more in line with reality. Tired of the legal back and forth, and Tamara actually explained that it had recently gotten ugly again. We already told you the backstory about Wendy and Dan's legal issues, but Tamara went deeper into the whole tactic they had of changing attorneys all the time to conflict out each other's legal counsel. But now it was spiraling down even further because Dan was having trouble finding a good attorney, and he was really ready to go full force against Wendy. Tamara told Isom she had just had dinner with Dan on her birthday on June 4th, and he confided in her that things were not going well. Everything else in Dan's life was, however. His career was on fire, his love life was great, but the only thing that was consuming him were the legal issues with Wendy. He just felt like it was never ending, and he wanted them to end. Actually, Dan's close friends, a couple named Maya and Alex, told Tamara that the timing of Dan's murder seemed very odd because according to them, Dan was about to drop a legal bomb on Wendy in the next week. That bomb would finally discredit her statements when it came to all those financial matters we talked about. The family heirloom that she never gave back, the $500K she was allegedly hiding, and of course, let's not forget the hearing was coming up about Donna not having unsupervised visits with the boys anymore. Tamara said within the first hour or so after getting the horrible news about Dan, she was already thinking about Wendy and their relationship. She didn't feel good. She had a bad feeling. She even told Isom she felt somewhat disloyal by divulging all this about Wendy, but she just noticed that things seemed off, especially in regard to the timing. But it wasn't just that. She drove straight over to Wendy's late night on the day Dan was shot, almost to see Wendy for herself and observe her demeanor. When she got there, Wendy answered the door. She appeared calm, and she hugged Tamara right away, saying that she was so sorry. But oddly, one of Wendy's friends that Tamara had never met before was, in her words, playing bodyguard to Wendy by not letting her get too close to Tamara. She felt that was odd.
Yeah, I felt that was odd too, and she called her Janine. Weird. And she said that this lady was named Janine, and she was in the interview, and then I kept saying, maybe she's mistaking it with Jane. Because Jane was the only person
right.
that we saw go into the interview room. So I was a little bit confused about that.
That makes sense.
But yes, Donna even came out and hugged Tamara. And she noticed the boys were just running around like nothing had happened. It was like they didn't even know that their father had just been shot. I mean, of course, I understand they were little boys and they wouldn't know what was going on. But it just seemed odd. And then Tamara went inside. And she and Donna talked about how Donna found out the news. Donna explained what we already know, that Wendy called her from the police station and Donna and Harvey drove all night to get there. Tamara said that Donna's reactions seemed appropriate, but when it came to Harvey, that's when she felt uncomfortable. He'd always been very friendly, but when he saw her, it was like he could read her thoughts or her facial expression or body language or something because he couldn't even look her in the eye. That had never happened before and it really bothered her. He was usually a lot more personable, and she acknowledged that everyone grieves and reacts to these things differently, but it was just everything combined. Even the fact that Charlie wasn't there, that was strange to her. Granted, she knew she hadn't seen him in a while because he didn't come to visit Tallahassee. She only saw him all those times she went to South Florida. But considering how close Charlie was to Wendy, it was weird that he wasn't by her side. But what we know that Tamara didn't, was that Wendy would be by his side within hours of all this because she would be back where she always wanted to be in South Florida with her family. And Tamara actually asked Wendy about Jeff when she dropped by. She was like, "Where's the new guy? Why isn't he here comforting you?" And Wendy's response was, "There is no new guy." That really threw Tamara off. It was like, poof, he's gone after she had just been gushing over him on June 17th, a month before all this. It's almost as though she was using Jeff. It seems like Wendy always has a role for the people in her life until she doesn't. Also, when Tamara was at the memorial, she said that she actually witnessed Donna ignore Ruth and walk away when Ruth asked about being able to spend some time with the boys. She said that Ruth turned to her and said something to the effect of, "I hope I didn't just see what I thought I did," meaning that Donna just turned around and walked away. Tamara saw it and thought it was odd. Tamara also added an interesting piece of information about Wendy's book. Remember Wendy's book?
Mm-hmm.
The Story of Us, The Story of Her. She said she'd been very close to Wendy while she was writing it, but Wendy never told her anything about the book until it was done. When Wendy handed her a copy, she recalled opening it up and going to the bio section, all about Wendy, and reading it. It said that the author was a mom of two boys living in Tallahassee, and there was no mention of Dan, even though, according to Tamara, he'd been so supportive of Wendy. It seemed odd. So when the divorce finally came, Tamara remembered back to the book and thought, wow, Wendy knew this was coming. Tamara said she couldn't actually imagine any of them, like Wendy or her family, pulling the trigger. But she said she wouldn't put it past Charlie or Harvey to maybe do something that Wendy wasn't even aware of. That Harvey had a lot of animosity against Dan. And Charlie hated Dan for how he treated his sister. But she truly hoped that she was wrong. She didn't want Ben and Lincoln to be orphaned if Wendy's family had anything to do with this. But if they were involved, she really hoped that Wendy didn't know. And all this is so interesting.
Yeah.
Starting with Wendy herself saying that she hoped someone didn't do this on her behalf, right, to Dan's own uncle pointing fingers at the Adelsons, to Tamara, close friend of both Dan and Wendy, saying she felt this was personal.
Right.
That it wasn't random. It seemed intentional. Almost like they knew his routine. Tamara said, it must have happened before or after he went to the gym after dropping off the boys. Isom perked up when Tamara started talking about Dan's routine. He inquired about what was normal for him. And Tamara said that people close to Dan knew that he did the same thing practically every morning. When he had the boys, he would drop them off, then he would go work out. This was helping Isom with Dan's timeline, which would ultimately lead them to their next clue and a break in this case.
But before we get into that, we want to tell you about Jeff's interview. There were several, but the very first one occurred Monday, the day following Dan's memorial, while Wendy and her family were on the road back to Coral Springs. 42-year-old social work professor Jeff Lacasse, the most current boyfriend of Wendy Adelson, was interviewed by Detective Corey Hale and Detective Isom. One of the very first things Jeff wanted to know was whether this interview was on the record. When they said it was, he asked if it was possible for them to go off the record first because he had a few theoretical things he wanted to say, but not directly be quoted on. They told him maybe later. First, they wanted to know all about who he was and what the relationship was with Wendy. We kind of already went into this in our last video, but of course that was Wendy's perspective. Most of it's the same, where he worked, how they met, how long they'd been dating, and so forth, so we won't repeat that. But what we will focus on are the things Jeff mentioned about Wendy and his perspective on their relationship. One thing we want to point out right away was that Jeff was a bit apprehensive in regarding to talking about Wendy. He was still in love with her. Their relationship had just recently started to have issues, and he said there was still a 1% chance she may get back with him, so he felt awkward saying anything negative or divulging personal information. Eventually, he did open up about his feelings for Wendy, as well as what their most recent issues were about. At first, he was singing her praises, telling the detective he was so in love with her that she's the type of girl you'd throw yourself in front of a bus for. She had charisma, she had sexuality, and he was under her spell like many other men. She had a way of essentially getting men to fall for her, and she had no problem telling Jeff about all the men that worship her. Or even having her boobs hanging out in pictures all over Facebook. These were in Jeff's words. He did say people have warned him, saying she's toying with him, but he couldn't resist. He even became close with her boys, even though he usually went over to spend the night at her place every night the boys weren't with Wendy for the last 9 months. He eventually began hanging out and going on outings with the boys and Wendy. He said he's the one who would know Wendy best over the course of the last year, because they'd been together so much, he basically co-parented her kids. But recently, he began to have trust issues.
There were signs that she wasn't being faithful. One was the time he caught her going to coffee with that Daniel Sack guy that we talked about in the last video. She used to be seeing both of them at the same time in the beginning before she got serious with Jeff. Well, Daniel moved away, but Jeff backtracked through Wendy's phone calendar and he saw a number of entries of when they hung out together while Jeff and her were dating. So she was going zip lining with this other guy to museums. So of course, like many of us, he confronted her about it just a few weeks before this, and she was not happy. Jeff said Wendy doesn't do well with confrontation, that she's very fragile emotionally. She doesn't like feeling ashamed or guilty or being called out when she got caught doing something wrong. She deflects and she gets defensive. She's depressed and anxious and definitely has baggage, but she does a good job by getting by on her looks alone. But she's super codependent, especially on her family. They baby her. They don't even trust her to take care of herself. This is all according to Jeff. They won't even trust her to make the 7-hour drive between South Florida and Tallahassee. Instead, Jeff explained her parents would drive her there and then fly back, or fly there and then drive back. And speaking of South Florida, he said Wendy went there a lot. The last trip she made a few weeks ago was for 2 weeks with her family. And on that trip, she had become very distant. She had the habit of being out of touch when she was down south. This made Jeff assume that there was another man, especially when she was out late and she wouldn't call him or text him, but she would give him the excuse that she was just really busy with family and the boys. In the 14 days she was gone on this last trip, he only got 3 phone calls. He didn't really know what to believe because he stated that Wendy lied a lot. He's been shocked by how easily Wendy can lie straight to his face.
I've been shocked how easily Wendy lies to my face.
It was almost sociopathic, and that she didn't have it all together like people thought. He said she was even more of a mess lately. She was miserable. He'd never heard her as bad as this trip. He said, quote, it blew up her world, end quote. And it kind of makes me wonder what exactly went on during this last trip for her father's 70th birthday when she comes back and she's so disconnected. They went on a couple dates, but then she asked for no contact for an entire week, the same week that Dan was murdered. So they want to establish Jeff's whereabouts, and he tells them he already had a road trip planned to Tallahassee that week. He left on Thursday, the day before Dan was shot, and he's been gone the whole time. He just got back in town and used his credit cards the whole time so they can check it out. Now Jeff goes back to the whole, I want to tell you something off the record. But the detectives tell him, if this has anything to do with guilt or culpability in this case, we really can't stop the recording. So Jeff, not wanting to be misunderstood or provide too much hearsay, he just states, I would be investigating Charlie Adelson. It's that simple.
I would be investigating Charlie Adelson.
Okay.
Maybe it's that simple.
Well, of course, they want to know why. And his response is because Charlie is very angry about Danny. Then he explains, if they had him in front of them, he would set off their radar. Jeff told them he used to do juvenile psychology and forensic psychology. And remember, Jeff is a social worker. He's been trained to look for signs. And he saw signs in Charlie when he met him. He gave Jeff the creeps. He said not only was Charlie a weird guy who set off his radar, but he was a conduct disorder kid growing up. He hates Danny, and he went on to say that Charlie reeks of antisocial behavior. He's socially inappropriate. And he gave an example. Jeff said that when he went down to South Florida with Wendy, they hung out with Charlie, and one night they're in the hot tub, and Charlie just randomly starts talking about sex acts that he's done to his girlfriend that he did to punish her for bad behavior. And he's saying this right in front of his sister. It's just weird. Like, kind of makes you wonder. Jeff just felt like he was strange, and he knows how fiercely protective Charlie is over Wendy. But there was more, much more. First of all, there's his nice house, his flashy cars, an abundance of wealth, his connections. Apparently, Jeff said Charlie hung out with people in harsh crowds and that he was bragging to Jeff about hiding finances, like tax fraud kind of stuff.
And I'm not trying to play cop here, but I do know one thing you'd be looking for is a lump sum of money moving around and some kind of crazy stuff happened. And I think there's a lot of financial irregularities. I think there's a lot of tax fraud kind of stuff, putting stuff in different people's names and moving money around, and there might be cash. I don't know exactly what, but he's not doing anything on the up and up in his finances. It was pretty clear. It was pretty open about that.
It mentioned that he hung out with a guy in the special forces, guys who fought in Afghanistan, and shady people that he met in clubs in Miami while he was drinking and doing drugs. It's kind of a lot of weird things to just tell someone.
Yeah, really.
Jeff said Charlie's sense of right and wrong didn't really exist. He'd even heard Charlie say in regard to Dan, quote, I'd like to kill that motherfucker. And that is why, if he were the detectives, he'd look into Charlie. But then Jeff did admit that he's also said that before about Dan, that he would like to kill him as well. But he didn't do anything. Second, and most importantly, Charlie's got a lot of money to throw around. He's a millionaire. He's really cocky, arrogant, street smart, impulsive, angry, narcissistic, aggressive, self-centered, and also a liar, just like Wendy. Jeff said he could easily lie. And he was a womanizer on top of all of that. Jeff said he had 3 girlfriends at once. Not that that was, he was like, people do that. But what he was getting at was he didn't care. Like, he doesn't care about people's feelings. And what's more is that Wendy actually told Jeff something. She reported that Charlie considered all of the options possible to take care of this problem. Jeff said it was last summer when her petition to relocate was about to be denied, and Wendy confided in Jeff. It was supposed to be a confidential conversation. Wendy said in a dead serious type of way that it would be convenient if Danny wasn't around anymore, and something to the effect of Charlie looked into how much it would cost, or that she thought Charlie might have. Jeff was pulling this from memory, so he wasn't too sure about the exact words, but the sentiment was there. He remembered it because it was chilling. It made his stomach flip.
Wendy had reported to me that Charlie had considered all the options possible to take care of this problem. It was chilling because she said, "Can I tell you something confidentially?" And I said, "Sure." She said, "I think Charlie kind of looked into some options, like literally saw how and why and how you would do this if you did it. Something about it would be convenient if Danny wasn't around anymore, but, you know, once he doesn't want anything to happen to him or something like that." She said, "But Charlie actually looked into like how that would be done and how much it would cost." She might have said, "I think, Charlie." I don't remember. But it was chilling. In the moment, I was like, my stomach flipped. I was like, whoa.
The crux of the statement is, my brother Charlie has looked into how much it would cost to
take care of somebody. She said it in a dead serious, chilling, uncomfortable kind of way.
That's pretty telling.
I'd say so.
Jeff said Charlie was the first person that came to his mind when he heard that Dan was shot.
Charlie popped into my head within 20 seconds of hearing this.
But just like others have said, even Wendy herself, Jeff said he could see Wendy being surprised that Charlie did this without her knowing, without Charlie ever telling Wendy he was going to do it. Jeff said, quote, "I could see Wendy being innocent, puzzled that Charlie did it," end quote. And Jeff made sure he was clear that he doesn't think Charlie would have done this himself, but that he would have the means and the connections to get it carried out. He'd get his buddy in the special forces to do it, or some seedy guys down in a Cuban neighborhood in Miami. Well, if that's not to the point, I don't know what is.
I got the email and I thought of Charlie within a couple moments.
Okay.
That's what I thought of.
Charlie personally or Charlie hiring somebody?
Hiring somebody. No way, Charlie. No way.
Can't?
Wouldn't do it. Wouldn't do it.
Couldn't pull the trigger?
I don't know about that. I don't know him that well. He get his buddy in the special forces to do this, or he get some CD guys down in the Cuban neighborhood or something like that. That's what he would do. Something like that. I mean, the main thing I told him was that Wendy had told me that he had looked into how much it would cost last summer.
Many of the same thoughts we've heard are being echoed, and Jeff wasn't done. He mentioned that not only did Charlie set off his radar, but Wendy's whole family was creepy. He said, quote, "The family is so unhealthily enmeshed that Wendy is not really an adult," end quote. Jeff stated that they were a pretty screwed up family. I wonder what he means by that in the moment. I mean, I know what he means.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like he's been witnessing the family the whole time. He's like, these guys aren't right.
He's a great gauge because he has a background in mental health.
Exactly.
He can see the signs. He's trained to see the signs. And now he's looking back and he's going, okay, that's strange.
Totally. So now the detectives wanted to know why Wendy's family would have hated Dan so much. I mean, sure, we know there's been a lot of back and forth legally regarding the kids, and there's motions coming up about money and those supervised visits regarding Donna. But is all this a motive that they'd have to get rid of Dan? For context, Jeff explained he'd only been around Dan for about 20 hours in total. That's if you combine kids' outings, events, exchanges of custody on days Wendy swapped with him, sports games, and stuff like that. But the very first time Jeff met Dan, Dan was very insulting. In their initial 10-minute introduction, Jeff said Dan insulted him multiple times, mostly in relation to status as a professional. Dan would ask questions like, "Oh, so you're an attorney? Where'd you get your degree?" Just kind of belittling Jeff.
Oh, and we have friends that have done that at dinners before, like gone around the room and go, "Oh, so where'd you get your doctorate from? Where'd you get your doctorate from?"
Oh my God, I remember
it's
that.
It's like, okay.
Where'd you go to school?
Where'd you go to school? It's like, does it even really matter?
No.
And Jeff wasn't an attorney, so Dan already had a one-up on him. And that's kind of the personality he had, which was natural, like Tamara said.
Right.
He's not trying to be like that. It's just something he values.
Jeff just stated that Dan was an arrogant guy. He was unlikable, and he talked down to people.
Probably hated Danny. Her parents hated Danny.
Do you know why?
Probably hated person. He is so arrogant. He is so unlikable. He would just talk down to people. He was one of these Harvard guys.
Okay.
And it was just like, we met for the first time. He insulted me 3-4 times in
really?
Sentences, just in subtle, like, haughty, snobby kind of way. Like, oh, are you a warrior? You know, and just little comments here and there.
But it was how Dan made Wendy feel that bothered Jeff even more. He said she was scared of him. She'd even have full-on panic attacks whenever she had to see him. He was emotionally abusive, controlling, a control freak who would control all their finances and run everything. From this behavior, Jeff even wondered if Dan had beaten her. Jeff even said Wendy told her all her friends begged her not to marry Dan because he was the biggest a-hole they'd ever met. But she was caught in the elitism that he was a Harvard Law graduate, so she made the bad decision. She hated living in Tallahassee, but we already know that. But Jeff went further to explain that Wendy was left doing everything at home while Dan worked all day, and he didn't get home till around 9. She was, in Jeff's words, a house slave, and that Dan was at... She was, in Jeff's words, a house slave, and that Dan was an absent father. He'd only have about 10 minutes of playtime with the kids, but then Wendy filed for divorce, and then he wanted full custody of the kids. Jeff then asked the detectives if they looked at Dan's court filings against Wendy. Jeff said they were almost insane. He said Dan would call her names and be ranting like a lunatic, and whenever she'd receive another motion from Dan, she'd have a 2-week meltdown. That Dan was, quote, manipulating the legal system to keep her in stress, and it was punishing her, end quote. Remember, this is Wendy's perspective of what Jeff, the man who is in love with her, believes from what she told him and what he sees her act like. But you can imagine if this is the way he sees things, imagine what Wendy's family may think and feel. The baby of the family being treated that way, constantly stressed, depressed, trapped 7 hours away, imagine.
Right. And they're always going to be on Wendy's side. They don't want to see her hurting. They want her to be in South Florida. They want her to be close so they can be with their grandkids. But they are all listening to what Wendy is saying. But at least the detectives have a lot of information. Most importantly, potential suspects and also Dan's routine. Remember we said there was going to be a break in the case? Well, over the next few days, detectives began to look at the locations Dan frequented. One was the Creative Preschool and then Premier Fitness and his home. They contacted the preschool and confirmed through a man who worked there named Keith Leland that Dan dropped the boys off the morning of Friday, July 18th. And when they asked about a green Prius, Keith said that interestingly enough, they kind of keep track of the vehicles that come and go for safety reasons. And at one point, within minutes of Dan Markell being there, this man, Keith, recalled seeing a green Prius in the parking lot, one that he did not recognize as another parent's vehicle. And that's pretty interesting.
Did you notice any other vehicles hanging around the time that Mr. Markell was present at the daycare that day?
Yes, ma'am.
And tell us about that.
Us being in school, we take extra measures of security. So whenever any of our staff hear a door opens, we just automatically, me, myself, since I work out in the office, come out of the office and just look, see who's coming through the door. That happened at sometime that morning, and I looked out and I didn't see anybody come in, but I did hear the door open. So that's what made me go out and look. And when I went to the door, I saw like a little car facing towards Tharp Street.
Okay. And where was the car?
It was parked directly in front of our main building, which we call the big school.
And do you know the make and model of that car?
I don't know the model. It was a Prius. I know that.
All right. And do you know the color of the car?
Well, I wasn't sure because it kind of flips color. When the light hit, it was like a grayish green, silver color.
All right. And did the Prius hang out there the whole time that Mr. Markell was in the daycare?
I can't say the whole time, but I do know when I went back out there at one point when the door opened again, it was gone.
Then the detectives went to Premier Health and Fitness and requested records that would show whether or not Dan Markell had checked in that day, and he had. So they asked the director to pull up video surveillance from the parking lots as well as inside so they could see if they noticed anything unusual, if there was anyone following him, and what he was doing when he was there. They spot his car on the footage, entering the north parking lot on July 18th at 9:11 a.m. Then you can see his car again on another camera angle towards the front of the building. He proceeds to park right behind this American flag. But here's the thing. Remember the green Prius? Well, they spot it coming into the parking lot from another entrance at 9, 12, and 34 seconds, within just a minute of Dan Markell pulling in. It's almost at the same time that Dan's parking his car. You can see it past the front of the building at 9, 12, and 37 seconds, and Dan's car hasn't moved, and he hasn't gotten out yet. The Prius actually passed right in front of him. That's creepy.
Spooky.
Then Dan Markell exits his car at 9, 12, and 42 seconds and walks to the front of the building. He enters the gym at 9, 13, and 18 seconds and walks in with a red shirt on and black shorts. There's another angle of him checking in at the front desk with his card and then going to work out. Meanwhile, at 9, 16, and 25 seconds, the Prius comes back around to the front of the building and passes right in front of the gym and in front of Dan's car. On another camera view, the Prius is picked up again at 9, 16, and 51 seconds, just driving around the parking lot, almost waiting for Dan to come back out. Again, at 9, 24, and 21 seconds, the Prius is going back towards the front of the building again. And about an hour later, they've been there an hour, around 10:32 a.m. or so, Dan is caught on the interior camera, and now he's exiting the front door of the gym. There's another view of him exiting. He goes to his car. You can see him right here in the parking lot walking toward it and getting in at about 10:34 a.m. In our last video, we explained that Stuart Schlazer from SAS had texted Dan that morning while he was at the gym at 9:56 a.m. Dan texted him back as he was leaving the gym at 10:36 a.m. while he's parked out front in his car. He's in his car for a few minutes, at which point he calls his mother, Ruth, and he backs out at 10:38 and 15 seconds. You see him leave the way he came into the lot, and guess what? The Prius is following close behind him. So there's a connection right there. It appears as though he was being followed at both the preschool and the gym, and now on his way home by the exact same type of car that his neighbor James Geiger reported seeing flee the scene of Dan's home after the gunshots. Unfortunately, there were no Ring cameras in the neighborhood to catch the license plate of this vehicle or show it actually coming into Dan's neighborhood. So at first, detectives go in another direction. They do a cell tower dump. They did this in the Brian Koberger case as well. It's when they find out which cell phone towers are close by to a certain location. We're talking about Premier Gym, so that's where they're starting. And then they ask for all the records of any cell phones that were active in that area connecting to that tower at a certain time frame. If the person in the Prius had a cell phone and it was connected to that tower near Premier, they may get a hit on their identity, but this can take a while. So in the meantime, one of the detectives had an idea. City buses. This was so interesting. They knew that city buses were equipped with cameras that faced the front of the bus for safety reasons, to record people putting their bikes on the bike rack and taking them off for theft reasons, and to keep records. So they find out all the bus routes that day, which is really clever. And sure enough, there were a few buses right in that area around the time that Dan would have been leaving the gym. They were hoping that one of these buses caught a glimpse of the green Prius.
This is all going to take time, so it's a waiting game at the moment. When Tuesday morning comes around, unbeknownst to Ruth, Wendy and the boys have left town. She calls Wendy that morning, assuming she's in Tallahassee at her home and ready for Ruth to come by to spend time with her deceased son's children. She was so excited to even hear their voices when Wendy picked up the phone, but that excitement quickly turned into disappointment. It wasn't until hours later, after Ruth was spending time going through all of Dan's belongings at his home, which of course made her very sad, that Wendy then informed her of the bad news. Ruth called back, this time telling her she gathered a bunch of the boys' toys and she couldn't wait to bring them over. But that's when Wendy dropped the bomb on her. She said, quote, unfortunately, you can't see them. I was so worried about their safety and mine that we left the house and drove back to Miami right after we saw you, end quote.
That is so cold.
Heartless.
It's just unbelievable to me.
Ruth was stunned. She was like, but Wendy, yesterday you said Ben and Lincoln were too busy to see us. Wendy said, I know. I wanted to tell you, but I couldn't. You know, for safety's sake. I'm sure you can understand.
She cannot be serious.
Rude.
She's acting like Ruth and Dan's family are the enemy when we really know that couldn't be further from the truth. All I could think about were those poor little boys. I even cried last night telling
you
about how Ruth gathered up all of these toys at Dan's, like thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to save these. And she was so excited to bring them over. And just to be told that they're gone? I don't know. And she was just so confused. And she didn't know if the boys would even remember her. And I just kept wondering if anyone, like maybe a professional, like a child psychologist, had a chance to sit with these boys and explain to them what was going on in a way that they would understand, or if they just had no idea.
So messed up. In Ruth's book, she explained that her blood was boiling when Wendy said all this, especially because the police had specifically told Dan's family that they had no concern with the boys' safety, that this was a targeted attack, and there was no reason to believe that the boys were in any type of danger. I mean, of course, it's always better to be safe than sorry, but Ruth couldn't help but to think that this was all planned.
Yeah, thank.
It just happened way too fast. All she could think about were the boys and what they must think and feel, and she wondered if they would ever even know she loved them. Ruth could not believe Wendy would do this. How could she alienate Ruth's own grandsons? No one knew Wendy was leaving. Not her, not Dan's mutual friends, not the police or the investigators. Ruth said, quote, "Dan had been shot on Friday, died on Saturday, memorialized on Sunday, and by Monday, his children and their mother had up and moved to Miami," end quote. She now understood why Wendy's house looked so empty. It's because she was on her way out. She felt like a pawn on a chessboard.
And I told you, Wendy has a role for every player in her life. Yeah. And once she checkmates your king and she expects you to just surrender and disappear from her little chessboard.
Ruth had no time to think about Wendy at that point because she had to worry about getting Dan's body transported all the way to Canada to be buried. She had a long road ahead of her. By July 24th, she was back home laying Dan to rest at Parde Shalom Cemetery in Maple, Ontario. And by October, her uncle Laser would pass away and she would be dealing with yet another death in the family. And the Markells, including Shelley's three kids, Ben and Lincoln's cousins, they had all been barred from seeing them. She wouldn't get a chance to see Dan's boys again until April 2016. Ruth wondered if they would ever even remember their dad's side of the family at all.
Wow. That's unreal.
It's harsh.
And for the record, Ruth began working on a bill in Florida for grandparents' rights in cases like this. She wanted the existing law at the time to be expanded to allow grandparents access to their grandchildren in circumstances like this one, whether it would be a divorce or a death.
Back before all this, in the days following Dan's murder, investigators were still busy interviewing witnesses, waiting on evidence testing, and to get their hands on more videos. But there were no suspects yet, and the media had gone crazy in Tallahassee and beyond. This was a major news story. Especially locally, it had been called the biggest case since Ted Bundy.
Because Ted Bundy happened in that area. That's why. It's not like overall, but in their area, this was like the biggest thing that had gone on.
The community was invested. Dan was like a local celebrity and they wanted justice. There were tons of theories swirling around, but no new leads just yet. However, a tip line had just been set up as well as the $1,000 reward for any information leading to an arrest.
A couple days after Wendy's ex, Jeff Lacoste, was initially interviewed, he came back in on July 23rd because he had some additional information that he wanted to provide to detectives. And it gets even better this time. He said that he had done some thinking and now he wasn't under Wendy's spell as much as he was the first time around. He had that 14-day break when she was in South Florida, plus the week that she wanted no contact, and now another week, and he still had not heard from her, which really speaks volumes to me. It really looks like she was just using Jeff for a number of reasons, but the audience can give their own opinion on that. Jeff thought it was odd that they were so close. They were even co-parenting the children, yet she hadn't reached out once. Jeff knows so much about all her court cases with Dan, and it struck him as very odd that she just kind of pushed him away. Even if it was that she no longer wanted to be with him, it was just strange. It seemed cold-blooded. Jeff starts out by saying that he spent $2,000 on therapy trying to figure out how to deal with Wendy. These are his words.
I spent like $2,000 on therapy trying to figure out how to deal with Wendy. She's been really hard to handle.
And looking back, he said that his therapist was concerned for months that Wendy sounded like a sociopath. But in the same breath, Jeff was like, "Well, I would go back to her in an instant because I'm in love with her regardless." And he would still stay with her, knowing all the things we're about to tell you. He explained she's got a fake public persona. She puts on a facade. She doesn't get close to too many people because she doesn't want them to know the truth. It's like she's got all these very shallow relationships. She's super social, but she really just cares about her image. She's very manipulative, and he feels like she had him under her control. Behind the curtain, he said she was a train wreck. And his therapist said she met the criteria of a narcissistic sociopath, but he just never wanted to see it. However, we've said this before, he works in the mental health industry. He has experience with all this, and now he realizes going back that she's got sociopathic tendencies, even though he says she's high functioning and attractive.
He, for months, has been concerned that she's a sociopath. No sense of guilt, no empathy, hypersensitivity to criticism. She's a total pathological liar. You see, behind the curtain, she's a total train wreck.
Then, when he started thinking back to Dan's motions and how Dan would talk about Wendy's systematic pattern of deception, it started to make a lot more sense to him. Jeff said Wendy had no sense of guilt, no empathy, and she would never admit when she was wrong. She was also a pathological liar. She apparently told Jeff in the past that she had trouble telling the truth.
Her and Charlie both have this sociopathic kind of thing where it doesn't seem to bug them at all.
And that she would lie all the time. But Jeff still feels bad saying all this because he still loves her. There's also some odd timing of things that he noticed as well. 9 months of dating and she still hadn't put a picture of him on Facebook, and she had no pictures of him anywhere in her house. She gets back from that trip to South Florida and she becomes really strange. On Tuesday, the week that Dan was murdered, they had plans to go to yoga. Before he meets up with her, she's being really sweet, but then something happens between 3 o'clock and 7 when they finally meet up. He seemed irrelevant all of a sudden, but it got even stranger. She's acting distant. She says she wants to take a break. But as they're walking to his car, she's like, "Are you going to be in town this weekend?" And he thought, why would she care? This is the same night she writes him this email that she says she wants no contact that week. So he wondered why she cares so much about his whereabouts. She just kept questioning him specifically if he would be in town on Friday, which turned out to be the day that Dan was shot. His reasoning was that she asked him for no contact so that he wasn't around, since he could read her so well. And maybe she knew that something was going to go down in relation to what happened to Dan. Then he shows Detective Isom a picture of Wendy. We're going to put it up on the screen. She's wearing like this kind of revealing purple dress on Facebook. It's this photo right here. Jeff said then him and his friends who have kids have been talking about Wendy's choice of posting this particular picture as her profile picture, because apparently she looked really good, you know, as it is. But in this picture, her cleavage was kind of pushed up. Her kids weren't looking at the camera, or according to Jeff, there were better pictures of the children or something. And he said that he could tell it had been photoshopped or doctored in some way. According to Jeff, she looked way better than she normally does in that picture. And what was odd to him is that she changed her profile picture to that picture on Thursday night. His thought was, if she knew there was going to be a media frenzy, you know, her picture was going to be picked to be plastered in the news, then maybe she chose this picture on purpose. I'm not too sure how important these things are. They kind of sound like they're coming from, you know, an understandably hurt guy, but maybe there's something to it. The timing does seem odd.
Investigators had theories and they had motives, but the people that they thought could be potential suspects also had alibis. The Adelson family, Harvey, Donna, and Charlie were all in Fort Lauderdale and Miami, 7 hours away at the time of Dan's murder. Wendy was at home with a TV repair appointment her mother had arranged for her, and records from Best Buy showed that a service call took place at Wendy's house during the time of the homicide. And that green Prius, which is referred to by the investigators as the suspect vehicle, that car that was following Dan was not a car that anyone they had spoken to owned. After analyzing the surveillance videos, the suspect vehicle was determined to be a 2006 to 2009 Toyota Prius with silver pine mica paint color. And that color looks like a light metallic green color. Sometimes it looked white if the sun hit it just right. But the gym footage of the car didn't provide much of anything. It was way too blurry. So they began looking for stores along Dan's morning path that may have cameras. And that's when they discovered that the Prius had actually been following Dan even before he dropped the boys off at preschool. A bank surveillance camera caught Dan Sedan's Accord on Benton Road a little after 8:30 a.m., with the Prius right behind him. By July 23rd, the police had released a still image of the Prius to the media, hoping that someone could recognize the vehicle. Finally, the waiting paid off. The city buses.
Oh my gosh, I thought this was so clever. I've never seen this in a case before.
That's great. At 10:44 a.m. on July 18th, one of the buses that was approaching Thomasville Road caught Dan's black Accord on its camera. His car was traveling south on Thomasville in the direction of his home. 10 seconds later, you can see the Prius on the same road going in the same direction following Dan.
They got so lucky with this bus footage, because that same bus made the right turn. And after this, it pulls up right behind the Prius.
Wow.
And while it's following Dan on Thomasville around the same time, you can see it there stopped at the light. If you're watching, the bus gets real close to it too, but it's still really hard to make out the license plate number. That's not really why these cameras are created on the bus. So as the bus is falling behind, it catches the Prius in the far left-hand turning lane going east on Benton Road, which we all should know by now is one of the roads that leads up to Trescott Drive, where Dan lives. And this was at 10:51 and 32 seconds. Now, investigators believed that Dan was shot about a minute later at 10:52 a.m., according to the call he was on at the time and the gunshots that James heard. Around 10:51 and 48 seconds or so, the Prius makes that left turn. Now, 5 minutes later, at 10:55 and 23 seconds, there's another bus going northbound on Thomasville. Now, that would be leaving the area of Dan's home. And it catches the same Prius, now heading away from the scene. This was after Dan was shot. This was the killer making their escape. This footage provided some additional clues to detectives, three important ones that they used to identify this vehicle. For one, the mirror on the passenger side was black. It appeared to have been an aftermarket part because the other side is the original color of the car. It had been replaced and mismatched. Secondly, there was what appeared to be a SunPass transponder on the windshield to get through toll roads. And third, the car was missing a tow hook cover on the front bumper. It's on the bottom right-hand side. There's just a hole left behind. And if you watch carefully, in slow motion, there are actually two people in that car. The passenger looks like they're wearing a white shirt. The same bus catches up to the Prius on its front camera as it speeds ahead north on Thomasville, which is toward Interstate 10. The biggest clue was probably the SunPass transponder. I always felt this was more of a South Florida thing because I had one when I lived there. It's a prepaid digital pass that you put on your dashboard to quickly go through tolls without stopping. Well, the closest toll system to Tallahassee is north of Orlando, which is about a 4-hour drive away from the Tallahassee area. The investigators were having a really hard time identifying the person that was driving this Prius. Detective Isom said there were thousands of Priuses, and a lot of them had SunPasses attached to them. So they were at a dead end, and they had exhausted all of their options at this point.
But remember they did that big cell phone tower dump? That consisted of hundreds, probably more, random phone numbers. And what they were attempting to do was pinpoint if any of the phones connected to those numbers had traveled near a toll road leaving Tallahassee on the day of the murder, and also near Premier Gym. Well, they finally got a hit. They looked at the GPS activity on the phone number that pinged off a cell phone tower near Premier. It was a number starting with 786, which is a Miami-Dade County area code. Now they were getting somewhere. The GPS also matched up time-wise with the SunPass transponder that activated at Alligator Alley Toll Booth going eastbound on I-75 toward Naples en route to Fort Lauderdale on July 18th in the evening at 5:23 p.m. This would be in direction leaving Tallahassee for South Florida. When they pulled the footage at the toll booth, the Prius is seen passing through. Now they had the serial number of the SunPass and they could run records to find out the same SunPass transponder activated on July 16th at 2:18 p.m. traveling from South Florida going through the toll booth at the opposite end of Alligator Alley, getting on I-75, this time heading westbound toward Naples to Tallahassee, and again they pull the footage and they see the Prius going through. Not only do they have the phone number for somebody who's presumably in that Prius, but they have the SunPass serial number, so now they can find out who owns it.
And it turned out the SunPass transponder was registered to a rental car agency in North Miami called Hybrid Auto Leasing Center. Interestingly, I wonder who else lives in Miami. I don't know. When the investigators asked the rental car agency to pull records for who rented a green Prius on July 16th, 2014, it was a man with the name of Luis Rivera, and he had provided a contact number on the rental agreement. He also provided information for a second driver who he labeled as his brother. His name was Sigfredo Garcia, and his contact number was also on this agreement. And I had to stop and think, don't people know not to leave a paper trail? I mean, we are putting the actual agreement up on the screen for anyone watching. It's all there in black and white. They wrote down their address and everything. They made the investigator's job a lot easier, considering this information is correct, that is. Remember the 786 phone number? Well, it turned out that number belonged to Sigfredo Garcia, the second driver on the rental agreement. So now if all this information is accurate, the investigators probably had the name of one or both of Dan's killers. But who the hell are these guys?
And why would they want Dan Markell dead?
I don't know, but y'all have to wait till the next episode to find out. We are so sorry about that.
Part four.
We're probably going to wrap everything up. And I'm so thankful that you have the patience to be here. I think it's very interesting. I love doing deep dives. There's just so much information that I don't feel we should leave out. And we have so much more to come.
Oh, there's so much to come. Well, like always, please subscribe and hit that notification bell so you don't miss out on part four.
And thank you so very much for watching. We will see you in our very next episode. Bye.